16. Books comes to my place, my mother's place, technically, to do more research and then spends the night. It's the first night we've spent under the same roof since I broke off our engagement. Yeah, it's weird. It's Alice in Wonderland weird. But it's a long drive back home for him from here, so it made sense for him to stay. But it's kind of weird. We're in the kitchen. I'm at the table with my laptop, checking emails and my familiar websites, while Books is cooking some pasta. He's a better cook than I am, which isn't saying a whole lot. Actually, we used to cook together all the time, opening a bottle of wine and nibbling each other's necks while we chopped vegetables and stirred sauces. Good memories. I have a lot of good memories with Books. He's the only person in the world besides Marta who ever truly got me, which is probably why things didn't work out.
You have any red pepper flakes?
Books asks. I have no idea, I say absently, combing through my emails of recent fires, eliminating the easy ones, flagging for follow-up anything that raises my hackles. Look around.
That's great advice. I thought if I stood here, closed my eyes, and opened my hand, it would magically appear. You say I should look around?
My smartphone buzzes on the table. It's Dorian. I'd called her earlier today and left a message. Hi, Mom.
You said you had good news, she tells me.
There is a faint slur to her words, a problem she's had since my dad passed away 5 years ago. She never gets falling down drunk, just likes to lubricate the edges with tank and tonics before dinner. It got worse for a short time after Marta's death. Marta, I always thought, had been her favorite, their shared features and cheerleader happiness thing. When I was growing up, Dorian was wont to say things to me like, I just don't understand you, Emmy, when she really meant, why are you so different from me? Why aren't you more like Marta? I do. I'm gainfully employed again.
With who?
What do you mean with who? With the Bureau, Mom. I have my job back.
Oh, that's great. They brought you back early?
Yeah. I showed them my research on the fires and they agreed to open an investigation with me on the team. Silence. Mom was always ambivalent about this obsession I had with all these fires. She thought that I was looking for something positive out of Marta's death, that if I could tie it to a crime that I could solve, I could make it all mean something. Marta died so we could catch this killer, something like that. She has never believed that Marta was murdered. This is where the mother says to the daughter, "That's great, honey."
If I thought it was great, Emily Jean, I'd say it was great.
Books is on the team, too, I add, thinking that might perk up her attitude. She always liked Books. Everyone likes Books. I glance over at him, stirring penne noodles while the steam hits his face.
Harrison? I thought he quit the FBI after you broke up with him.
Lovely how she put that. He did quit the Bureau, Mom, but not because I broke up with him. He quit because he'd done what he wanted to do and he was looking for other challenges.
I don't believe that, Mom says. He quit because it was too painful for him to be in the same building as you.
Well, he's right here, so let's ask him, I say, feeling a little testy. Books, come here and tell my mother why you quit the FBI. Books puts down the wooden spoon he was using to taste the pasta sauce, wipes his hands with a towel, and walks over to the table. He takes my phone.
Hi, Dorian. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Yeah, the book business is tough these days, but we're doing okay. How's Naples?
Good to hear.
Great. Anyway, the reason I left the FBI was because Emmy broke up with me.
He hands me back the phone. I've never seen so wide a smile on his face. That's not true, I protest to my mother. He's just saying that.
I'm not just saying that,
he calls out, his hand cupped over his mouth.
He's not just saying that,
Mom joins in. Mom, I gotta run. This has been one of our more enjoyable chats. I punch out the phone. That was real sweet, Books.
Pasta's almost ready. You about done with that research?
Just about.
I don't think there were any arson victims last night.
Well, that's too bad. Actually, that's good, right?
Books plates the food. Penne with red sauce, steamed broccoli with garlic, a little salad. I notice for the first time some small flecks of gray at his temples, more noticeable with the longer hair. He catches me looking at him, and I break my eyes away. If evading intimate moments were an Olympic event, I'd have a gold medal. By the time he's opened the bottle of wine, I'm done with my breaking news emails and regular websites. For now. They come in like avalanches throughout the day.
You work too much,
he says to me as he sits down. I make a face. Coming from you? The wine, something Books bought in town, has a coppery taste to it. Too pungent.
Well, that was something I realized about myself when I left the bureau,
he says.
Life isn't all about work.
No? What are you, taking up mountain climbing all of a sudden? Parcheesi?
Don't put down what I'm saying,
he says. I'm not putting you down. I would never put you down. Books takes a long drink from the wine, savors it in his mouth, swooshes it, swallows, then lets out a pleasurable sigh.
Leaving me at the altar was kind of a put-down.
That wasn't a put-down.
No? What was it? A compliment? A ringing endorsement?
I kind of like Books like this. Looser, more sarcastic, more relaxed. It was a life decision, I say.
Oh, I feel better already.
He winks at me.
Forget it, kid. I'm over it. Eat your food now, understand? You have to impress our team tomorrow.
17.
Graham Session, recording number 5, August 29th, 2012. Hello? Hey, honey, I'm great. Oh, really? Great. What? It's hard to get reception down here. Oh, I'm in Champaign, Illinois. Remember that website maintenance company I was telling you about? Picture Perfect Designs? Curtis Valentine. Well, I'm in his basement office right now, and I gotta tell you, this place is amazing. No, even better than we thought. Curtis, I'm sorry. I hope you don't mind me taking this call. We've been talking about this appointment all week. Okay, so I'm walking away from Curtis for a moment, and I want to tell you, my audience, something. I said I wasn't going to let you see or hear what I do up close for a while, and I'm not. I'm going to shut this off before I do it, but you have to see how good I am at this. How completely I've gained his trust. That I can just walk up behind him and steal his life away. How effortless it can be if you have discipline and focus. And, yeah, I guess, I also want you to see how exciting this is for me. It's still exciting. It never gets old. I wish you could feel this rush I'm feeling. The joyous pump of my heart and the electricity that fills my veins. This euphoria that overcomes me. I mean, you get it, don't you? This isn't about hate. This is about love. Okay, let's do this. Walking back to Curtis in 3, 2, 1. Anyway, honey, you should see what Curtis can do with a website. I think we can do some crazy cool business with this guy. Curtis is sitting at his workstation, and he's got, like, what is it, Curtis? How many do you have? 4? 4 different computers working together. And he's in this zone. Like he's consumed with what he's doing. Like he has no idea what I'm about to do to him. End.
18. Books and I show up at the Dick's office at 5 p.m. as instructed. But we are redirected to a conference room down the hall.
Scheduling this meeting at the close of the business day is a message in itself. The dick is not planning on devoting much time to us. But then, he makes matters worse by making us wait for more than 2 hours. Finally, at 7:15, he saunters into the conference room, munching on something. The jerk probably had dinner while we waited, and drops into a chair without acknowledging us. He spends 10 minutes wiping his eyeglasses with that same silk cloth, which is his way of making it clear how important we are to him. Glasses first, investigation second. He has brought 2 people with him, contract consultant and former agent Dennis Sasser, and a research analyst named Sophie Talamus. This, apparently, is our team. Denny Sasser has a forehead of age spots, only wisps of white hair on top, sunken eyes, and narrow, crooked shoulders. He got mandatory at age 57 and, after a couple of waivers from the director, retired. But he was retained as an outside consultant and has worked in several areas since then, the latest of which is asset forfeitures, an assignment that is about as desirable as a goiter. Usually that assignment means, we're not going to be renewing your contract, pal. So he's not exactly climbing the ladder, which is good because I don't think he could climb a ladder if you held your hand under his fanny and pushed. He's been with the Bureau since before the invention of electricity. The dick tells us that Denny once worked on some arson cases, but I'd wager a mortgage payment that those cases took place back when you created fire by rubbing 2 sticks together so you could cook the stegosaurus you killed with a spear and dragged back to the cave. Sophie Talamus, I don't know. She must be new. She's younger than I am, which unfortunately isn't saying a lot, and a lot prettier. Refer to my previous comment. Whether she's good at her job or not, I have no idea, but she's probably still wet behind the ears and will need some grooming, which I don't have time for. So this is not what you'd call the A-team. The dick made sure of that. We've been set up to fail.
All right,
Dickinson says as he wipes the last specks off his eyeglasses.
I am not going to waste precious resources on a fishing expedition.
He dons his glasses and looks us over with disdain.
I've reviewed the so-called research that Emmy has put together, and so far what I've concluded is that there is nothing here. There are a bunch of fires, of course, but there are fires every day in this country. There are fatalities in fires every day. All that I see here is that our Emmy has compiled a list of fires, all of which have been determined by fire investigators to be accidental.
The dick shakes his head.
I don't see a single case here where the United States could get a conviction in court beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's true, I chime in. He's that good.
He's that good, the dick replies, or there is no master criminal. These accidental fires really were accidental.
If I may say,
says Denny Sasser, lifting his hand off the table, indicating that he is, in fact, capable of movement.
Ms. Dockery, I don't see a pattern here. The cities are different. The victims come in all shapes and sizes, men, women, black, white, Latino, Asian, old, young, wealthy, middle class, poor. What's the unifying theme?
These fires have taken place on every day of the week except for Sunday,
says Books.
So we have to consider a religious angle. Maybe a religious connection between the victims. Maybe they were all sinners, and this is a religious zealot casting the heathens into the fire. Or maybe a satanic thing.
I have to admit I'd noticed the never on Sunday thing, but never attached any significance to it. Books did, though. It was the first thing he noted, which is why I need him.
Satanic?
Sasser says.
Because of the fire?
Books shrugs.
Could be. We should consider a numerology analysis. Maybe the dates or the addresses of the victims or the ages. A connection to 666, the number of the beast and all that. Sophie, that would be a good assignment for you.
Sophie, she of the large brown eyes, silky blonde hair, and cute little figure, perks up. Okay, Agent Bookman.
It's Books,
he says.
Everyone calls me Books.
Okay, Books. She smiles at him,
He smiles at her. Even Dickinson is smiling at me, a gloating, toothy grin.
Oh, Dickinson, you little weasel.
That's why you added Sophie to the team, because you knew Books would be attracted to her. Enough. Get a grip, Em. This is the chance you've been waiting for. This is showtime. It's time to explain a few things to these folks. 19. These cases haven't been investigated properly, I say. The locals are taking the easy answer, which is precisely what our subject has given them, an easily explainable accidental cause. Arsons are very easy to cover up because the evidence goes up in flames. Sometimes the arsonist makes it easy on you by splashing accelerant around the place, gasoline or kerosene, which can be detected in the aftermath. But otherwise, arsons are usually detected in very non-scientific ways, like a gas can or bottle bomb found at the scene, a knife found next to a cut gas line, eyewitness reports of someone fleeing the scene in the middle of the night, maybe even a strong motive, either a financial one or some personal dispute. The point being, if an arsonist is careful and meticulous, he can usually hide any evidence of his crime. And our subject, I believe, is very careful. He doesn't leave anything behind that would arouse suspicion. He picks victims with whom he has no connection, and on top of that, he hands investigators an easy explanation on a silver platter. What are investigators going to pick? The easy explanation, every time. Denny, who has listened attentively to my monologue, dutifully nods, but I see I haven't won him over.
Ms. Dockery, he says.
Call me Emmy.
If Sophie gets to address Books informally, Denny gets to do the same with me. Somehow this doesn't make me feel like I've evened the score. He gets Malibu Barbie, I get Grandpa Walton.
Emmy, we have to consider the possibility that the easy answer is the right answer, says Denny. If there's one thing I've learned in over 30 years on the job, it's that the simplest answer is usually the correct one. You're asking us to believe that a genius arsonist is at work based on the fact that there's no evidence of arson.
That's understandable. That, in fact, is why our subject is so good at what he does, because the proof that he's a good arsonist is the lack of proof of arson. I don't have all the answers, I concede. We need autopsies, forensic analyses of the crime scenes, witness interviews, everything.
We don't have the resources for that, says the Dick.
Then we have to convince the locals to do it for us.
Based on what?
Denny Sasser asks.
I just don't see the evidence.
Neither do I,
the Dick chimes in. I look at Books, who gives me a curt nod.
Show them, he says.
20. I place a poster-size map of the United States on an easel near the end of the conference table. All around the country, little stars have been placed where one of our fires has occurred. 54 stars in all, 32 of them red, 22 of them blue. Here are 54 fires, I say. 54 fires since basically Labor Day of last year until the present. So that's a one-year period. As you can see, the fires occurred all over the country, from California to New York, from Texas to Minnesota, from Washington State to the Florida Panhandle. 54 fires, all determined to be of accidental origin. 54 casualties. The room is silent. There is something about death, even for law enforcement professionals, even if I'm totally and completely wrong about my theory. Either way, 54 is a big number, a lot of dead people, and there's no room for mirth or wisecracks. These 54 fires, I believe, are linked. Why are they different from the hundreds, if not thousands, of other fires that occur in homes across this country on an annual basis? They are unique because they all have four things in common. First, they were determined to be accidental. Second, there was always one and only one casualty. Third, in each of these fires, the victim was found at the point of origin of the fire, In other words, the victim was found dead in the same room where the fire started. And fourth, that room, that point of origin, was always the bedroom.
That's unusual?
Asks Denny Sasser. Very, I say. Fires don't usually start in bedrooms. The vast majority of house fires start in kitchens. Others are caused by faulty gas lines in basements or laundry rooms. Some start with electrical wires that arc, often near heat sources, behind stereos and things like that. But bedrooms, it's actually quite unusual. Denny allows for that.
I haven't studied recent statistics.
I smile at him. I have. But regardless of the room where it started, most people don't die at the source of the fire. People run from a fire. They don't run to the fire. What commonly happens in fires involving death is that while people are sleeping, the fire originates somewhere else in the house, the kitchen, the laundry room, and starts to spread. If there are deaths, it's usually because the victims died of smoke inhalation after their path to safety was cut off. They don't usually just get burned to a crisp while lying in their beds. In each of these 54 cases, the victim died in the same room where the fire was determined to have begun, and in many of these cases, they were found dead lying on or near their beds.
Certainly, though, it could happen innocently, says Sasser.
Certainly, Denny. In fact, you've just articulated the feelings of 54 different sets of fire investigators, each of whom have determined that their single fire was accidental. Just looking at a single incident? Sure, it's possible, especially when they find an obvious, so-called accidental, cause of the fire which our subject always hands them. They go with the easy answer rather than dreaming up some diabolical plot. But we are not looking at one incident. We're looking at this nationally, and we're seeing 54 incidents in a one-year period. This, I submit, is a pattern. I have the room's attention. I'm not great at reading faces, but I think I've cleared a preliminary hurdle with them. Maybe nobody is convinced yet, but I'm not way out of bounds either. But let's break it down further, I continue. Let's start with a 4-month period beginning a year ago, approximately Labor Day of last year, and continuing until year's end, or January 2nd, to be specific. Focus now on the red stars on the map. These represent 32 fires that occurred during that 4-month period. Note the scattered nature of these fires, hitting all corners of the country, but not the Midwest. These 32 fires killed 32 people. The last fire in that period, the January 2nd fire, was Peoria, Arizona. I still remember the phone call from Mom, the panic in her voice, her inability to even get the words out to me.
Marta, she said. Marta was... Your sister was...
It took me over 5 minutes to get her to finish the sentence, though after a few attempts, my own panic had begun to rise as it became clear that the news she was delivering was the worst possible.
Marta was what, Mom?
I cried, my voice cracking, my knees buckling, the ground beneath me splitting open.
What happened to Marta?
So that's 32 fires in 4 months,
Books says, coaxing me along, helping me, sensing that I'd locked up from the memory. I give him a nod of gratitude and snap back to focus. That's right, I say. So that's approximately 2 fires a week. And as you can see from the map, the fires tended to be in clusters of 2. 2 in California, Piedmont, and Novato in the same week in September. 2 in Minnesota, Edina and St. Cloud, in the same week in October. So our subject was a traveler. From Labor Day to basically New Year's Day, our subject traveled. Why? I don't know. Everyone is paying attention, at least. The lovely Sophie is even taking notes, indicating that she does, in fact, know how to spell. Or at least doodle. But then we get to the second time period, the beginning of this year through the present, I say. And this is when we start to learn more about our subject. 21. The second phase of our subject's crime spree, I say, is the roughly 8-month stretch from January of this year to today.
These are the blue stars on the map. During this stretch, we have 22 fires and exactly 22 casualties. Exactly one death per fire. Rather meticulous, wouldn't you agree? Denny Sasser and Sophie Talamus nod. Books does so emphatically, though he's already heard my spiel. The Dick sits passively, revealing no sign of his thoughts. With my pointer, I outline a circle around the blue stars. But our subject wasn't such a traveler during this second phase, was he? Books shakes his head.
All 22 of those fires took place in the greater Midwest.
That's right. Illinois, Wisconsin, Iowa, Indiana, Missouri, and Kansas. And this took place beginning in mid-January and through last week in Lisle, Illinois. So that's almost 8 months and only 22 arsons. Instead of a pace of 2 a week, he's closer to 3 a month. Why? I look over the team like a teacher quizzing her students. When they don't answer, I do it for them. He's taking longer to choose his victims, I say. Again, nobody answers. It occurs to me I might be annoying them with my question and answer routine, but in fact, they seem to enjoy it. Everyone in this room, at least in part, entered law enforcement because they like solving puzzles.
And why is he doing that?
Asks the Dick, the first time he's participated at all. I don't know whether to take that as a good sign or bad. Because he lives in the Midwest, I believe, I say. So the rest of his life intrudes. Work, friends, whatever he does. When he's traveling, he skips out and commits his crimes. But at home, he has a job to go to. He has friends, family.
He'd also have to be more careful,
Books notes.
If he's killing closer to home, he stands a greater chance of being caught. Heightened caution means more time between victims.
Exactly, I say. Note that every murder he commits in the Midwest is in a different jurisdiction of law enforcement. Different cities, different counties. He's making sure he doesn't commit the same crime in the same jurisdiction twice, for fear that people will start looking at these things as a group instead of one-off fires.
And you said the victims are always found at the point of origin where the fire started,
says Denny Sasser.
Is there some reason the subject would do that?
Sure, I say. The point of origin is the point where the fire burns the longest and therefore the hardest, where the most damage occurs, where the evidence is most likely to be destroyed.
Ah, so you think he's using the fire merely to destroy evidence?
I do. Whatever he's doing to the victims, he wants to make sure we don't find out. He doesn't want us to autopsy them. He wants to make sure that there isn't... I think of Marta, and my throat shuts down.
That there isn't a body left to autopsy, says Sophie.
I nod, unable to speak. I still remember my mother screaming at the mortician, at the police detective, at anyone who would listen.
I can't even bury my baby. I can't even give her a proper Christian burial.
I clear my throat. Books wasn't wrong about the perils of investigating a crime involving a loved one. I don't want to become a cautionary tale.
So the fire is secondary, says Denny Sasser. He's not setting fires for some thrill. He's covering up crimes. Is that what you're saying?
I clear my throat again. That's what I'm saying. And what he's doing takes time. That's why he seeks out people who live alone, so he can subdue them and take his time with them. Then when he's finished, he torches their bedroom. He knows that these days firefighters can arrive within minutes of a fire. He doesn't care if they save the rest of the house, but the victims will be charred before they arrive. Everyone digests that. I'm not sure I've convinced anybody that we have a killer, but I've convinced everybody that there's good reason to investigate further.
So, where do we start?
Asks Denny Sasser. We start where he lives, I say. It's somewhere in the Midwest. If I were to bet, I'd go with the Windy City. So pack your bags, everyone. We're going to Chicago. 22.
Graham Session, recording number 6, August 30th, 2012.
Well,
I guess this can technically count as a separate session. It's past midnight, officially Thursday now. What a day it's been. Wouldn't you agree? No? Nothing? Well, folks, since I'm in a good mood, I'm going to answer questions from the mailbag. I wish there really was a mailbag, because I'm sure you have lots of questions for me. You'll try to answer as many of them as you can from these recordings to read between the lines and study my word choices and voice patterns and all that jazz, but it would be nice for you if I just outright answered some FAQs. So, from time to time, I'll just go ahead and guess what those questions might be and answer them for you. Thus, here is episode 1 of Graham's Mailbag. Cue the theme music, please. What's that? I'm being told that we don't have any theme music. Sorry, I'll have to work on that. Question: how do you choose your victims? The simplest answer I can give you is that I go with what inspires me. What inspires me at a given moment will vary, and thus my victims vary as well. You wouldn't expect Beethoven to write the same symphony twice, would you? Or Tolstoy to pen the identical novel a second time? Sometimes I seek them out, and sometimes they come to me. Sometimes I must grapple for a time with what I'm looking for, and on other occasions it simply comes to me like an exotic perfume wafting under my nose. I am, in a word, a connoisseur. Sometimes I prefer a nice piece of lamb with a Shiraz. Sometimes lobster with a chilled Chablis. Other times an Italian beef sandwich with peppers and salt and vinegar potato chips. I don't know what I'll be in the mood for the next time. I just know that my stomach will start growling sooner or later. Question: what is your favorite color? I'll bet you think my favorite color is red, don't you? Well, close. It's purple. Purple is such a twisted, complex color. It conveys the passion of red, the sadness of blue, the depravity of black. Purple is neither happy nor sad. It is pain and despair, but longing too. Fiery desire, beaten and bruised, but struggling onward, determined to overcome, to move forward, rather than retreat. Plus, it looks nice with my hair. We have time for one more question. Why set fire to your victims? Well, let's see. Curtis, have I set fire to you? No, I haven't. I've done a lot of things to you, Curtis, but I haven't set you on fire. Now, don't lose your head over this, Curtis. I will burn you up when this is over. But that's just so our fun is kept a secret. Sorry, everyone. That was a little inside joke between Curtis and me about losing his head. And if it's any consolation, Curtis, you have one of the nicest-looking brains I've ever seen. Is that consolation? Do you feel consoled? You'd probably feel a lot more consoled if I got rid of this mirror, wouldn't you? End.
23. Lieutenant Adam Ressler is not happy to see us. Not that I can blame him. A week ago, he had this case all wrapped up, and now we're here to ruin his Labor Day weekend. His thoroughly starched uniform looks stiff and hot in the sweltering August sauna that assaults me as I slide out of the Jeep Cherokee we got from the Chicago field office's fleet. Ressler wears the uniform well, though. He is handsome, well-built,
clean-shaven with a just-right angular cut of the jaw, and he carries himself like a man who has spent time in the military. If it weren't for the rivulets of sweat escaping from his perfectly combed hair down to his precisely creased collar, I'd hardly be able to tell he noticed the heat. "Lieutenant Ressler, I assume?" I ask, trying to sound breezy, cool, and confident, as my hair begins to stick to my neck and forehead. He grunts his assent without offering a handshake. Denny, looking wilted, clambers out of his car and joins Books, Sophie, and me on the sidewalk. I do quick introductions. Ressler is quick to shake Books's hand, presuming him to be the leader, which happens to be true, but he doesn't know that. Typical sexism. But it's no time for my feminist side to show. He looks over Denny Sasser with a you-gotta-be-kidding-me expression. Denny looks like a half-melted ice cream cone, but I'm beginning to suspect he's got more going on behind his hooded eyes than he lets on. Ressler seems awfully impressed with Sophie, as would any heterosexual male with a pulse.
"Ms. Dockery," Ressler starts, "like I said on the phone, this fire was clearly not incendiary in origin. I don't see why you need to see the scene. If you could just tell me what you're looking for, I'm sure we could get this wrapped up."
"You've been such a help already, Lieutenant," I say. "We just need to take a look around, that's all." He glares at me for a moment, then turns abruptly and stalks toward the house. I guess he didn't like being told to babysit the FBI for the afternoon. I pause for a moment to examine Joelle Swanson's first and last home of her own. It's a modest, two-story freestanding townhome with a brick facade and round pillars at the top of the cement stairs leading up to the entryway. It's new. The whole neighborhood is pretty new, with tiny, hopeful trees and postage stamp lawns still striped with new sod. There is plywood over some of her windows, and the power is probably off, but there is little other evidence of the devastation of a week ago. Except for that smell. Burnt tar, melted plastic, and an undercurrent of something unidentifiable but clearly chemical, all bundled with the jarringly pleasant smell of damp, charred wood, like campfires in the autumn.
"The fire primarily affected the back of the house, as you can see," says Ressler. "The back bedroom was completely involved, as were the master bathroom and the hallway. The rest of the house suffered smoke damage, and of course everything is still damp from the fire suppression, even a week later."
I stop for a moment to take it all in. For all the research I've been doing, this is the first torched house I've been in since Marta's. The house is completely different, of course, but it throws me back anyway. Marta's was a typical southwestern home, rounded entryways, lots of tile, and adobe-colored everything with an open floor plan. This one is a more standard Midwestern layout, with a living room, half bath, and kitchen on the first floor, two bedrooms and a full bath on the second floor. I pause at the base of the stairs to brace myself. The walls are blackened starting halfway up the stairs, in sharp angles and lines clearly defining the path of the flames before they were extinguished. The char patterns, as I learned at Marta's house. I reach the landing and pause again. Closing my eyes, I can see the licking flames from my dreams. Angel fingers, the firefighters call them, snaking across the ceiling. The boiling smoke ripples like the surface of the ocean just moments before the second story erupts in flashover, simultaneously igniting every flammable surface and turning the cozy home into a convection oven. Ressler continues, thankfully unaware of my moment of hesitation.
"The point of origin was back here, in the master bedroom," he says. "Now be careful here. This fire burned really hot and fast and didn't make it through the floor joists. But I don't want to discover structural damage by dropping an FBI agent through the floor."
He laughs, rapid fire ha ha ha, to emphasize he's kidding. I'm not sure he is. We get to the bedroom. Joelle's bedroom, not Marta's, I remind myself. And I suck in my breath. The bed, or what remains of it, is positioned directly across from the bedroom door. Not terribly unusual, but not that common either. But it's like she and Marta read the same home design magazine and picked the same bedroom layout. And Marta's room hadn't been laid out that way the last time I'd visited her. She reorganized her room before she died.
Or so I thought.
Queen-size mattress with a bedside table on one side, or at least what remains of it. Overstuffed reading chair, no doubt once made of highly flammable polyurethane, with comfortable, equally flammable throw pillows and blankets by the window. Ruined piles of wet ash that were probably piles of books. The ceiling is gaping open to the sky, where the firemen had vented the fire to prevent smoke explosions.
It should be raining, I think.
It rained for Marta, even in Arizona, even in January. The four of us begin our examination. Joelle's body had been removed, of course, but we knew her remains were found among the ruins of the left side of the bed. The photos had shown her body curled into the characteristic burn victim posture, legs bowing outward, wrists curled in, arms bent, caused, I knew, by the heating and drying of muscles and tendons as they pulled bones like post-mortem marionettes. The char patterns, where they can be seen, show a narrow V-shape right to the side of the window, ending near the floor amid the blackened remains of the desk Ressler had indicated was the origin point of the fire. The carpet is melted and burned nearly completely, though a few places in the farthest corners still show the original color. After 2 hours of scouring every inch of the room, the four of us smell like incinerators. There is absolutely no evidence of an accelerant or of any intentional method of setting the fire that seems to have killed Ms. Swanson. Lieutenant Ressler and the Lyle Police Department had every reason to reach the conclusion they reached. But I'm surer than ever that this was the work of our subject. 24. So here's what we know, I say to my team, as we settle into a conference room at the FBI's Chicago field office. One, there was a candle, which likely was the point of origin one way or another. Two, the fire spread very quickly up the curtains and around the room until it reached the point of flashover, when everything in the room simultaneously combusted. Three, there was an alarm system on the house, but it was not activated at the time of the fire. Four, there was one window open in the spare bedroom across the hall from Joelle's bedroom. It was 82 degrees at 1:30 a.m. the day of the fire, and her central air conditioning was on. Her AC was on, but she left a window open. Five, we were unable to locate any other candles in the house. Joelle does not seem to have been a big candle user. Six, there is very little smoke staining on the unbroken windows or other glass surfaces, and the char patterns are consistent with a very hot and fast-burning fire. Those qualities are often indicative of a fire assisted by an accelerant. However, we found no evidence of accelerant near the origin of the fire or anywhere else. Seven, the fire triangle. Fires need oxygen, fuel, and heat to burn. There were books spread around her room, many of them open, and papers on the floor. That's fuel. A candle was left burning on a desk too close to a curtain. That's heat. And a window was left open across the hall. That's oxygen. And not only is that oxygen, but the path of the air being sucked in through that window would have ended on the wall directly opposite the door, which is the precise location of Ms. Swanson's body on the bed. And because the fire will burn hottest where it has ventilation, Ms. Swanson's body was in the hottest burning fire in the room and was almost completely consumed in a relatively short period of time, including her skin, fat layers, and much of her muscle. Eight. The DuPage County Arson Task Force has not been called. This fire was determined to be accidental by the fire investigator, and they have no interest in reopening the case. There will be no autopsy performed unless we can convince someone that there is a reason to do so, or unless we take over the investigation. Nine. There are 53 other fires that share nearly all of these characteristics. With my limited means over the last several months, I haven't been able to determine the positioning of the beds in each of the other 53 bedrooms, but I have obtained information on 18 of them, and they are all the same. I look at books, piercing him with my eyes so that he understands, including the one in Peoria. Sophie speaks up.
I think
All of these people moving their bedroom furniture around into the same position and then burning to death would be a reason for some autopsies, don't you?
Maybe Sophie isn't so bad after all. I'd like her even more if she gained 30 pounds and got some acne.
So we start right there, says Books. Let's find out about the positioning of those beds in the bedrooms. Let's finish the work Emmy started.
I nod at Books. And time's a-wastin', folks, I say. Because 2 days from now is Labor Day. And if our subject keeps to form, that means he's about to take his show on the road and start killing 2 people a week.
25. Graham Session, recording number 7, September 1st, 2012. Good evening, class. Tonight, I won't be taking questions from the audience. I want to say a few words about lying. A key ingredient in any respectable artist's portfolio, lies are fascinating because they expose the paradoxes of our society. What is a lie? It's a distortion of reality presented as reality. We say it's a bad thing. We teach kids not to lie. We even put people in prison for lying. And yet, there are lies all around us. And half the time, we don't even really try to disguise it. The TV commercial with the bubbly family ecstatically stuffing French fries and burgers in their mouths with the fun-loving clown looking on. We all know those are actors who are paid to play a fun-loving family. They're not having fun. They probably had to reshoot that scene 20 times, and they're tired and nauseated, and the last thing they want to do is stick another French fry in their mouths. And what about those thick, scrumptious burgers in the ad? Are those the ones you get when you go to the restaurant? None of that's real, and we know it, but don't care. Women wear clothes that hide their flaws. Men suck in their guts when those women walk by. Office workers turn the screen away from their game of solitaire when the boss strolls in. Lies, lies, lies. You're taught not to call someone who's fat, fat, or someone who's stupid, stupid. That's wrong, we tell our kids. Don't tell the truth if it's going to hurt someone's feelings. Those lies are okay, too. Desirable, in fact. I'm not complaining, mind you, just commenting. It gives me perspective. And that perspective is embrace it. Because if everyone else is lying, then you better, too. Or you'll get caught in the cross current, spinning and flailing. You don't want to spin and flail, do you? As you can imagine, I'm a master liar. How else do I woo all these unsuspecting people into letting me into their lives and usually their homes? Lying is easy, but being good at it is hard. Here is Graham's handbook on lying. First, lie no more than you have to, because for that duration of time you're with a target, be it 2 hours or 2 weeks, you're going to have to live with that lie. If you want to get close to a target who happens to be a smoker by saying you smoke too, which works, by the way, there's an unspoken brotherhood between all tobacco users, then you better be prepared to light up every few hours or so. What I do when I use that ruse is claim to be a former smoker. So, of course, I love to smoke, and maybe just this once I'll partake so I can have the bonding experience with my target. But I have an excuse not to smoke again if I have to spend a longer time with the target. Second, Be no more specific in your lie than is absolutely necessary. The vaguer you are, the more rope you give yourself. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. This last guy, Curtis Valentine. I found him easily because he runs a website design business out of his house in Champaign, and he's on Facebook, too. To get into his house, I told him two lies. One, I was starting a consulting business that needed a website. And two, I hired someone else first, but they scammed me and stole my money. I couldn't have gotten a meeting with Curtis if I didn't need his services, thus the consulting company, but I said I was starting one instead of operating one already, so Curtis wouldn't be suspicious if he looked up my company on the internet and didn't find anything. Why the second lie? Several reasons. Most website designers never meet their clients. They just communicate by phone and email. But if I got burned once by a scammer, it would make sense that I'd want to see this guy's operation for myself to make sure he was the real deal. Also, it would allow me to appear reluctant when he asked me questions like, "What kind of consulting will you be doing?" That's the last question I wanted to answer, because if I said I was a private detective or mechanical engineer, it might turn out that Curtis studied mechanical engineering in college, or his best friend or brother is a private eye, and then suddenly I'd have to actually know something about private detection or mechanical engineering. But with lie number two, I could just say, "I'd rather not say until I've hired you. You know, because I've been burned once before, etc." I lied no more than I had to, and I locked myself down as little as possible. A couple beers at a bar, Curtis talking about how he can expand my business's potential, me looking impressed, but also gun-shy after being burned once, and next thing I know, it's his idea that we go to his house so I can see his operation firsthand. Any questions? Good. Class dismissed for now. But don't go away. We have a lot of fun right around the corner. End.
26. The FBI building on Roosevelt Road in Chicago never really closes, because the FBI never really does either. But it's Labor Day and after business hours at that, so the building is about as empty as it will ever get. The eighth floor where our temporary digs are located is positively barren. Our four-person team, believing as we do, or at least as I do, that time is of the essence, has been doing its best to make progress. But we arrived on the Saturday of the three-day weekend and haven't had a regular business day yet. Still, we're trying to do the person-to-person stuff, calling local cops or county sheriffs in all the jurisdictions where our subject is killed, asking them to dust off the files on that accidental fire so they can tell us the position of the bed in the bedroom where the victim was found. Sometimes there are insurance company investigators involved, too, who often take more photographs than the cops because their money is at stake. So we'll be tracking them down when normal business resumes tomorrow. The good news is that computers know no business hours. So Sophie and I, the research analysts, have been trying to work cross-references, looking for any number of things that might indicate a pattern. We know, as much as we can say we know anything at this point, that he chooses people who live alone, and that each of these victims engages to some extent in social media, be it Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever. But there has to be more. Something has to be connecting these people. Nobody acts completely at random. At 7 o'clock, I get up to stretch my legs and peek into the office next to mine where Books is stationed.
"Thanks, Sheriff. That would be much appreciated," he says, rolling his eyes when he sees me. "Call me anytime, day or night.
You have a good night, too.
He hangs up and makes a face. He's been making calls to the upper brass in the local jurisdictions, trying to persuade them to reopen their investigations or, at a bare minimum, conduct an autopsy on the body. The problem is that even if the FBI takes over the investigation from the locals, all of these victims have been buried, so an autopsy would first require us to petition the court for an order of exhumation.
He said he'd talk to the family about an exhumation, he says to me.
You don't need the family's permission.
He nods.
But you start there because you can avoid having to go to court if you get consent. Anyway, I think he's just looking for a reason to turn us down.
He blows out a sigh.
Emmy, these departments have closed these cases, in some instances several months ago. If we want to get autopsies, we're going to have to go into each jurisdiction's local court to get the grave opened. And that assumes the local U.S. attorney is even willing to go to bat for us, which is no small thing.
Then we'll try.
Right, but you know how long that's going to take? A few weeks would be the minimum. Dickinson, he just hasn't given us the manpower.
Can you get more agents assigned?
That's the catch-22, lady.
Right, I agree. We can't get more agents until we show him some hard proof. And we can't get hard proof anytime soon without more agents. And all the while, our subject just keeps on killing. Which is why I'm pinning so much on the two most recent deaths, Joelle Swanson in Lisle, Illinois, and the latest one, a man named Curtis Valentine in Champaign, Illinois. We haven't been down to the Champaign site, but a detective down there with Champaign's police department was kind enough to have a video done of the entire house and email it to me. It was a single-family house, not a townhouse, but otherwise, the death of Curtis Valentine bore a startling resemblance to that of Joelle Swanson. A fire that started in the bedroom, the victim found in that same bedroom, a candle as the likely source, char patterns and minimal smoke staining indicating a fast-burning fire, yet no evidence of accelerant, the bed positioned directly opposite the bedroom door.
God, our subject is smart.
I have to admit, even I would think this looks accidental if I only knew of this one fire. None of these investigators know that this nearly exact same pattern has been taking place all around the country.
You look exhausted, Em,
he says. I am.
Let's get everyone together and get something to eat at the hotel bar,
he says. I sigh. I suppose if we get a change of scenery, we get away from phones and computers and just talk, maybe an idea shakes loose. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe we need to take a breath and think big picture, brainstorm. Maybe the trees are blocking us from seeing the forest. I look back at Books, who is smiling at me.
What?
I ask.
The only way you'll join us for dinner is if we agree to talk about the case, isn't it?
I raise my hands.
Is there anything else to talk about?
He shrugs.
We could talk about the Chiefs,
he says.
They kick off this weekend.
Books is a diehard football fan. It's one of his only flaws.
Okay, fine.
Books raises his hands in surrender.
We'll talk about the case. Maybe something will shake loose.
27. Our humble team hits the bistro located within the Chicago Marriott where we're staying, a place called Rook's Corner that Books has been all excited about because they serve Chicago-area microbrews on tap. Books always liked to take in the local favorites when he traveled, which, as an FBI agent, was often. The place is dimly lit with dark oak, yellow cushioned seats, and a hardwood floor. Booths line the walls, with tables scattered near a wraparound bar. A football game plays on the projection screens mounted on the walls. Books orders a Domaine DuPage, whatever that is. Beer, I assume. I recognize DuPage as the county in which Joelle Swanson was killed. While Denny orders a soft drink and Sophie, a berry mojito. Everyone is happy to have food. For Books, it's a burger. For Denny, a club sandwich. I order some French onion soup, and Sophie chooses a pear and pecan salad. Are pretty young women genetically programmed to order fruit-flavored drinks and nibble on rabbit food like salads with low-fat vinaigrette dressing? I mean,
Couldn't Sophie just break from type this one time and guzzle a Guinness while devouring some nachos with cheese sauce dripping down her chin? The aforementioned Sophie, I note, has the seat next to Books at our square table and has scooted her chair closer. She is hanging on his every word as he regales everyone with some war story. Special agents have lots of tantalizing tales about their exploits. Quirky witnesses, silly miscues, charismatic criminals they've captured. I've heard most of those stories by now. My favorite is from a dozen years ago, when Books was assisting U.S. Marshals on a fugitive recapture. He broke through the front door of a Maryland house, tripped over the coat rack, and was knocked unconscious when the rack came down on his head. The other agents had to step over him to get in. They later told him, "At least you blocked the exit really well." Sophie asks him,
"Have you ever hunted a serial killer?"
"Oh," he says, blowing out air. "I've worked on a few investigations, yeah."
He was working on one when we ended our engagement. He caught his killer, then resigned from the FBI. Reginald Traeger, who raped and murdered a number of young women in Portland, then sealed the deal by lopping off their heads. "Freddy the Machete," I say, because I know Books won't. Denny Sasser touches his chin.
"You worked on Freddy the Machete?" "It's not as impressive as it sounds, believe me."
As much as Books likes to tell stories, they usually involve him in embarrassing situations. Books isn't one to play up his own accomplishments. It was one of the first things I noticed about him when we met 4 years ago. He figured out the pattern of a crew of bank robbers in Virginia to the point that his team was waiting for them when they hit the Federal Credit Union in Arlington. All the research analysts on the team knew that it was Books's brain power that got the solve, but he spread the credit around, even walked through the office and left a card for each of the RAs, thanking them individually for their help and noting their specific contributions. RAs notice that kind of stuff. Most of the special agents forget all about us once they've solved their puzzles. Reginald Traeger, dubbed Freddy the Machete by the press in Portland, was an unemployed union painter who had recently lost his condominium to foreclosure and apparently snapped. He went on a rampage that included 5 or 6 victims, I don't recall the exact number. It came out later that he had a history of mental illness and a previous conviction for attempted rape.
"Did he come up with that name himself?" Sophie asks. "Did he, like, leave notes or anything? Did he want to be famous?"
I can't tell if she's flirting with Books or is professionally curious, trying to sponge up all the experience and wisdom she can. Here's a question. Why do I care? Books shakes his head.
"Reggie Traeger wasn't capable of leaving notes or wanting notoriety. He was mentally ill, a classic sadistic sexual psychopath. He beat women, decapitated them, and performed sex acts on them."
Sophie recoils.
"In that order?"
"Oh, yeah. He performed sex acts on headless corpses. Yeah, this guy was a real monster."
"What kind of sex? Never mind," Sophie says. "I don't want to know."
"No, you definitely don't want to know."
But I know. I'm probably the only person who knows outside the team that caught the monster. The detail was never made public, and Reggie Traeger hasn't even had his trial yet, so it's basically classified information at the moment. The sex act was vaginal rape, but he didn't use his penis. He used the machete. The blade penetrated clean through the uterus and colon until it came out their buttocks. The only minor consolation is that they were already dead, already decapitated. Books enjoys a sip from his pint of caramel-colored beer. He probably can't help enjoying the attention. I can't blame him. If you're going to leave the bureau, it's a nice case on which to exit. I take a gulp of my water, not being in the frame of mind for alcohol, and let Books bask in the glow a minute. But he's not much for basking, and I catch him eyeing me when I look his way.
"Emmy wants to talk about our case," he says. "So where do we start?"
"With your profile," I say. "I want to hear your profile of our subject." 28. Books smacks his lips after another sip from his pint.
"Can't do it,"
he says,
which he's already said to me several times. By several times, I mean every single day since I dragged him onto this case. He turns to Sophie, the pupil.
Before you can work up any kind of a meaningful profile, you first obviously have to establish the commission
of a crime, I interrupt. But Books, let's assume these are murders. Murders covered up by arsons. What's your profile? I know you have one. He allows for that and gestures to Sophie again.
Profiles are an art, not a science,
he says.
It's not like you can plug facts into a machine and crank out your profile. You have to thoroughly evaluate the crime scene, interview victims if you can, all things we haven't done here. And even then, you can be pretty far off.
Were you far off in your profile of Reggie Traeger? Freddy the Machete?
Sophie asks, practically cooing. If she gets any closer to Books, I might have to find a machete of my own.
Well, now that's a good example, Sophie,
he says, as if he's about to pat her on the head. He's not blind. He can admire her Barbie doll looks, and he can see the way she's looking at him.
We were able to analyze the crime scenes and the victims. It was clear to us that he didn't plan the crimes much at all. He wasn't careful or logical about his victim selection. He made no attempt to cover up his crimes or modify the crime scene in any way. His victims were violently mutilated, sexually assaulted, and decapitated. They were all white, early 20s, and blonde. From that, we drew our profile. We believed he was a classically disorganized killer suffering from mental illness. He was a white male in his 20s or 30s. He was socially withdrawn. He had no friends, didn't talk to neighbors, showed no interest in socialization whatsoever. He grew up in a family where he was disciplined severely, probably by a mother. He was likely a high school dropout. He had no meaningful relationships with women and was quite possibly impotent. He was either unemployed or engaged in manual labor. He had recently experienced something rather stressful, something like being fired from a job or a breakup with a woman. He had violent fantasies against women and was unable to control them. He lived somewhere within a 1 mile radius of the victims, and his first name was probably not Freddy.
Sophie gives him a full wattage smile.
Oh, that Books. He's a real jokester these days.
Why did you think he lived close by? She asks.
Disorganized killers usually don't travel by car. They're too caught up in their fantasies. It's not like they carefully select a victim, drive there, commit the crime, and drive home. No, they act on pure impulse.
Okay, yeah.
Sophie is transfixed by the professor.
So how were you wrong?
Well, for one thing, he took his murder weapon with him. Most disorganized killers use whatever's on hand. They aren't capable of planning to walk around with a weapon ready to pounce. But Reggie carried that machete under his long black coat and took it with him after every murder. Also, he kept a souvenir from each victim. That's atypical of disorganized killers who usually just commit the crime and leave. But the biggest thing of all,
Books continues,
is that his last victim wasn't random at all. His last victim was the same woman he'd attacked years before when he was convicted of attempted rape. So he had definitely planned that out. In fact, those things that distinguished him from the typical disorganized killer are the reasons we caught him. Once that last victim was attacked, a simple background check took us to the guy who'd attacked her previously, who just happened to live 7 blocks away from her. And once we rousted him, we discovered he had a machete and all those souvenirs.
What were the souvenirs?
Sophie asks, beaming.
Another thing you don't want to know,
says Books.
I do, come on.
He took their tongues, I say. He cut them out and kept them in a shoebox under his bed. I hate to spoil her appetite. She could use a good meal.
Anyway,
Books says, clearing his throat.
My point is, it's not like we drew up some perfect profile and nailed Reggie Traeger. It was dumb luck. He made a big mistake attacking his previous victim again. He might as well have sent us an engraved invitation.
That doesn't mean profiles can't help, I say. And it doesn't mean you don't have one for our subject.
I don't, Emmy. I need to know more.
Tell me one thing about our subject, Books, I say. Just one, and don't say he's highly organized because I think we all get that much. Books shakes his head, bemused. One thing, I say.
He's getting better, says Books. Organized killers improve and hone their methodology with each murder. Our subject was probably pretty good all along, but if he's real, if there really is a man going around murdering people and torching the scenes and making it look accidental, then he's turned this hobby of his into a well-oiled machine.
Books blows out air.
He's not going to hand himself over like Reggie Traeger did,
he says.
We're going to need good police work, yes, but we're also going to need all kinds of luck.
Oh my God, I say, pushing my chair away from the table. That's it, Books.
What's it? You found inspiration in we're going to need all kinds of luck? Wow, I knew I was good, but not that.
I've already left the table. I move from a brisk walk to a jog until I've jumped into the first taxi I can find.